Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the Black Spin Global podcast. I am Eugene.
And I'm Lucy.
And Lucy, we were joined again by a special guest slash co-host, Anne-Marie Batson.
Hello. Hello. Thank you, guys. I'm really excited for this. You're talking about one of my favorite sports, and I'm delighted to be chatting about it because there's been so much tennis going on. So thank you so much for having me on.
No, thank you for joining us. But yeah, like you just said in your introduction, there's been so much going on like in the past, week? As we all know, the tour is still suspended due to coronavirus / COVID-19 or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, we have had exhibition tennis, and the kind of story that we're talking about, is the Adria Tour event that was fronted by the world number one, Novak Djokovic. And so much has basically happened. Like, there's been huge fallout, since the start of the event, and like
it's been a mess. it's just actually been a mess.
Lucy, I love what you tweeted, that brilliant picture of Spider-Man, the two Spider-Men pointing at each other.
I had to
sum it up nicely, absolutely 100%.
That's what I kind of want to get into, like, the as serious as it is, like, there's been a lot of like humor around it as well, like, it's because it's literally such a serious thing, but then at the same time the stupidity of it all kind of makes it funny as well, if that makes sense.
Of course, you have to post a meme in serious, you know, that's how we go through these serious things, is posting the memes. Like, even the back on our minds, we're like shoot, this is really serious. We're like, you know, let's throw a little bit of banter in there.
Well, they say a picture says 1,000 words, and I think that picture absolutely summed it up. The story hasn't stopped, as we know. The story keeps
still going.
It's still going.
Because what were your thoughts, Anne-Marie? Like, when you like first saw the, I don't know if you maybe, were you following it from the beginning? Like, did you actually watch?
I followed it from the beginning. So I was actually on radio that day, and I was reviewing the papers, and I was asked about it, and I'd said the minute I saw the pictures of them hugging mainly hugging, shaking hands, and that video from the disco, alarm bells went off in my head. And I'd gone onto the Serbian website to see what the guidance was, so I could be clear in my mind what is it they were saying. And they were very clear about this social distancing, no hugging, no touching, all those kinds of things that we are currently undergoing here in England. And then again, I see this video and I see the photos and I see people genuinely concerned about what they are seeing. And then it all exploded when the announcement came from Dimitrov that he tested positive. And to be honest, I watched that match when he played, and yet, of course, you know, the beauty of hindsight, I can go back and go, well, he didn't look very well. He didn't look very well.
Apparently, a lot of people were saying that. Yeah,
he did not look well at all. He looked quite pale. Yeah. And then more videos came out of the kids' day. All the kids are around them. The basketball game, there's been ramifications from that. And as we said at the beginning, this story just keeps growing and growing, but it really did properly kick off. Grigor Dimitrov tested positive when he was back in Monaco, I think.
Because he was the first one to be confirmed, and then that's when the whole thing got cancelled, and then all the players literally had to get tested that night. But then apparently Novak Djokovic, he decided to leave. Like, he I think he got on a private jet and like went back home. So
I think he did that because he didn't want to be stuck there. Because I think if he, like, for example, he did his test and he ended up being positive, he had to stay there for 14 days. I think that's why he did it. So I can understand a little bit.
Right. So for the Nole family out there, there is a huge contingent of Nole fans, and I get it. I respect Novak Djokovic as a player and what he has achieved and what he will still achieve, because I truly believe he will overtake Federer at some point. He's still a young man. He's still got a long way to go.
True.
The thing is, though, this is something that he's going to have to live with and understand the ramifications of it. I appreciate and I 100% support the reasons why he did it. He wanted to do something from a philanthropic point of view. They were looking to mm-hmm. raise money. Mm-hmm. The history mm-hmm. between Croatia and Serbia and the rest of the Balkan states can be a little bit fraught, and it was an opportunity for these countries to come together. If you can, you know, if you think back, or if you know about the Bosnian War, Croatia War, you couldn't have imagined having a Serb standing on the same court as a Croat 20 years ago, and now you've got that today. And it's the two countries who traditionally didn't like each other very much have come together. They want to celebrate their countries and celebrate their tennis with the world number one. I raise my thumbs to that. Where it falls down, though, is what my sister called it, arrogance. Mm. It was the arrogant thinking that, you know, we can just go and do things as normal. And then to come out and say, but we followed the government guidelines. That's not what we're seeing. So it didn't match up. It didn't match up at all. And then you're thinking, well, okay, the government weren't strong enough then. Why didn't the government step in? And then you get told, well, actually, who are you to tell our government what to do? Yeah. So, you know, I get the reasons why he was doing it, and that's cool, but end result isn't what you thought it was going to be. You have to acknowledge that, and he has kind of done that in his apology. I think there was two, wasn't there? There was two statements that came out. The first one that came out from the Adria tour didn't really address it, and then the second one, when he tested positive, did acknowledge that he made a mistake, and he'll have to deal with that now.
Because that's one thing I think about, well, with Novak, like he's very much like concerned about like the perception, like his perception, like in the public eye. So
I think this
which is why I'm even surprised he did that, because it's like, even if you wanted to do something positive, donate. Like, you can really do, like, you guys are rich enough to chill in your bed and be sending a million or 100,000 or whatever. Like, you don't actually need to, you know, like, go out that much of your way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's why I was like, I don't know. He was already doing a lot before this whole thing. You know, all of his comments, you know, regarding COVID and his special positive water and anti-vaccine and all of these and all healing stuff. So now look.
No, it doesn't
it's
look
like good. It's like you've got these two versions of Novak. You've got the man who wants to help out the lower ranked players, wants to raise money for his foundation and do good in the world, which is great. That's not for me to judge. I applaud that. Then there's this other side of him that has his beliefs. And as you said, Lucy, it's like those beliefs are now impacted on the good work that he has done, because now people are questioning about, you know, like you just mentioned about the whole the vaccine. He's not a big fan of vaccines.
Yeah.
Very vocal about that. And yet it's overshadowed all the good work that he wants to do, as you rightly said.
Exactly.
It's totally overshadowed that now. And now they're talking about, should he remain as the head of the Players Council for the ATP? Yeah. Should he step down? What do you guys think?
Yeah, because I was going to get onto that as well. Like that, for me, that kind of leaves him in a pretty difficult position to be in, because I think you touched on it earlier as well, Marie. Like, it was very irresponsible. So for him to actually now, look at himself to say, you know what, I was wrong. Like, and it just doesn't really make sense if I was to kind of, you know, be the voice of the players, even though he is currently the world number one. I don't know. I think it's obviously at the end of the day it's his decision. But I think the right thing to do would be to step down. Just because it's, I think he needs to lay low. And Lucy, you kind of alluded to this in like messages to me in the week. But I think he should just lay low, and I think that will kind of help him do that. Like, to just stay out of the public eye, like, for a while.
No, that, I think you should, you know what, even the US Open, he should not go. I think he should stay at home, stay with his kids. So, like, 2021, we were back open, everything's back to normal, we forget about all of this. The thing is, at the beginning, I actually did say, I think he should step down. But then afterwards, when I looked at how everyone was just pointing the finger at him, I was like, hold on. Like, I get he's the one who organized this entire thing. But can people also keep in mind that if, let's say, for example, half of the athletes who said that they were not going to, let's say if they said they were not going to go, the tour probably did not happen. So everyone had a choice to make this happen as well.
The players could have stayed home. The fans could have stayed home. Like, a lot of people literally did not need to actually be there. And then the tour would have been an epic fail. That's why I was a bit... That's why, like, at the beginning, yeah, I was dragging him and making fun and posting all these memes. But then when I saw how everyone was, like, pointing at him, like, because I understand he's a leader. He's, you know, he's, like, you know, representing the players. He's number one and everything. But at the same time, these are grown-ass people. He's not the only one. Everyone should literally equally be blamed. But... again, the number one question is, why was he even allowed to even organize this tour?
Yeah.
And that's why I feel like they need to stop giving privileges to these big players. Just because they're big players doesn't mean they know, like, every single little thing. Do you get what I mean? I feel like a lot of things has not been taken into consideration during this entire tour. And now, look, so that's why I feel like this is a big lesson for him, but for the entire tennis community, from the fans to the staff to the manager, every single person who was involved into this. And that's why I say shout out to Monfils, who said that he's not going to go to Team's tour for personal reasons. He saw that Asia tour mess and said, I am the not problem involved.
With tennis, though, I think the one thing with tennis that needs to be addressed is that it's very much an international sport. And I think Judy Murray hit the nail on the head when she talked about suggesting that the ATP and WTA tours should be scrapped, or let's put those on hold until 2021 and just focus on domestic competitions. If Serbia just had it in Serbia, because Serbia, from what I understand, has had one of the lowest infection rates and the lowest amount of tragedy of people losing their lives in the Balkans, unlike England and France and Spain. So if he had just held it in Serbia, because apart from him, there are two or three players underneath him that are fairly good. I think he still would have got a good turnout, not a huge turnout, and it could have made him controlled a little bit better. But if you're trying to hold a tournament in Serbia, Croatia, Montenegro, who then knocked it on the head from what before, one more country as well, then the alarm bells will start ringing. And then you're getting in players coming in from other countries. Zverev from Germany. Who else did you have? Grigor Dimitrov from Bulgaria. Each country have had different reactions and different measures to tackle coronavirus. Everyone levels. Nobody's the same. So I think that was also the issue as well. If he just kept it in Serbia, and I don't know why he wanted it in other countries, but I reckon if he just had it in Serbia, he wouldn't be getting half the grief that he's
exactly yeah, no, just I, how like the Murray brothers are literally doing battle with the Brits, and absolutely I really enjoyed watching some of the matches.
We're gonna get onto that, definitely.
So that's just like an example, but you know, or even the small exhibitions that we're having in America right now and stuff. So
because I've got a lot to say about this. So the thing I will say is, I be like you, Lucy, over time, and I'm looking on the social media, I became a little bit uncomfortable about the finger pointing that was coming, not necessarily from the general public, but from, you know,
everyone,
Djokovic's family, example, Grigor Dimitrov's agent then getting involved, then you've got Goran Ivanisevic,
who tested positive as well now.
Positive, and now was, you know, was negative twice, now tested positive. At the beginning, when he was testing negative, he was like, oh, everyone shouldn't be pointing the finger at Djokovic, and then is now positive himself. And then there was another player who was critical of the UK or the England's response to the tour, saying, well, we've seen pictures of people on the beach at Bournemouth over the weekend, how can you criticise us? And I think, oh, goodness, this is like spiralling. And even Dimitrov's agent saying, you know, we were assured that certain things were going to be in place and those certain things didn't happen. My client is ill. Thankfully, he's still, you know, he hasn't developed the disease fully. Born in Chorich as well. Let's not forget about him. He's since tested positive. So, and there's loads of these fingers. Everyone's all pointing at each
it's
other.
Ridiculous.
And I think Lucy is 100% right. You cannot just look at Djokovic for this. I know people are, but he shouldn't be the only one who should shoulder the responsibility 100%. And acknowledge what happened.
Yeah,
100%. No, I completely agree.
And the thing is, I feel like this whole thing is also a bit embarrassing to the whole tennis community. So because I felt like tennis was like the easiest sport for you to play during this entire pandemic. You're looking at football, they're out here tackling, touching each other with their sweats and everything, and it's fine. And then tennis, one small little tool, and then boom.
but it's just that that's one thing that really annoyed me.
That's the gift and the curse though with tennis, because it's like and Emery, you said this earlier, it's a global sport, so players need to literally travel like around the world, so it makes it difficult to, you know, travel to this country and that country, whereas if we were to just have literally just national events where players, you know, from that country just competing in tournaments in that country, like it would make things a lot easier. But then obviously that means the tour would have to be suspended, because, you know, we can't have like ATP WTA like sanctioned events, like with just,
I mean, that's why from the very beginning as well I've been saying cancel the entire 2020 because and just do little exhibitions, and then let's start from 2021.
What do you guys think the fallout's going to be in terms of the US Open? Because obviously they confirmed that they're still looking to go ahead, obviously with no fans, so it'll be a fanless event. But off the back of this now, I don't know if there's been like official statement or word from them like in response to the Adria Tour stuff, but as it stands, like it's still going ahead. Like, what do you guys think? Do you think that's a wise choice?
The USTA is stuck between a rock and a hard place, the organisers of the US Open, because primarily the US Open is more of a commercial-led event. They need the big players to be there. And I think they want to... I view it as that they want to show that they can put on a tournament of this scale and manage the situation. The one question I would ask of the USTA is, how are you going to manage that situation if and when a player tests positive? Under our current England guidelines, that if someone tests positive, they isolate for 14 days, but they then have to contact everybody, potentially everybody, that they've been in touch or in contact with or met, and they then have to self-isolate. So if a player, if those kinds of guidelines are followed in the States, and we know that New York has had one of the highest in terms of level of infections and tragic deaths, if one player tests positive, how are they going to manage that? And I think when they did their press conference last week or the week before to announce what they were doing, the one thing I noticed, and maybe you guys saw this as well, is that I felt they'd watered down the entourage question. Players could have two rooms, and players, if they wanted, and if they can afford to do so, they can rent a place outside, I think it was outside of Manhattan. I can't remember. Outside Manhattan, outside Manhattan, because you know certain players are going to do that.
Oh, definitely.
So that then, the bubble then kind of is less restrictive. The bubble of the making sure that all the players are in the same place or are using the same hotels, now that you're suggesting that players can go elsewhere if they can afford to do so, and they can now have two rooms. But those two rooms can have twin beds, shall we say?
it does make a nonsense of it, definitely. Yeah.
Look, I think my gut is telling me it's going to go ahead, but they do need to address 100%. And reassure players and coaches and everybody involved, what is the plan, or what is the worst case scenario if a player tests positive?
Yeah, because Serena Williams, she's like probably the highest profile player to like confirm that she's going to be there, which is like a massive like coup for them.
Is why I think they've actually told players what they're going to be doing for them to make sure everything's going to be safe. I personally don't see Serena agreeing to play if they didn't sell to her and tell her this is exactly our plan from A to Z. Like, do you get what I mean? The thing is, she's in a position where she's a mom, she's a wife, she has a child. She cannot risk a lot. She can't take a lot of risk because of that. Exactly. So I don't think she would just hop on just to go. If it was back in the days where, you know, tennis was the only thing, then maybe. But seeing her announcement kind of put me at ease, because I didn't feel like she would agree to go with it if she wasn't happy with certain stuff. So I think they really had to talk to the players and tell them, like, listen, this is our plan, and we're just going to see how that goes. But I still feel like they should still go for it, because I don't think US Open are that silly to do certain stuff like the Adria Tour did.
I think there's going to be much more like stringent like rules and like regulations in place. So players will be tested, 100%. I think, quite frequently as well, which I don't think that was the case at the Adria Tour. So, but me personally, I
don't think players even got tested even before.
at the age of, what, the age at all?
I don't think so.
Which again is quite silly when you think about it, because I don't know if you guys...
That's what I'm saying. That's why when a lot of people when saying, oh, we should cancel US Open, I was like, come on guys, US Open are not literally going to do the same thing that they did. Do you get what I mean? The number one thing that they did was having like fans. First of all, like when you're literally watching it, there was like that fans. They weren't even social distancing. Mm. They were right next to each other.
Do you know what made me laugh about the Adrian tour? There was a picture of the opening day of the media day, and there was a picture that somebody posted on social media of the players all sitting together, shoulder to shoulder, and then there's a 2 meter line between the players' feet and the photographers, and then all the photographers and the rest of the press corps squashed together, and they're in a tent. 10 meters. And you're coming in, okay, so you've got a 2 meter line between the press corps and the players, but the players are all sitting next to each other, shoulder to shoulder, and there's no 1 meter or 2 meter distance going on. And it's the same with the rest of the press corps. Mm. I think with the USTA and the US Open, there'll be no media on site, no ball kids on certain, I think, and then it'll be ball adults on certain courts. You're right, they'll be tested to the hilt, 100%. But they do need to address that thing of what worst case scenario. And no doubt the reaction that's been generated because of the Adria tour, I would assume that the USTA is watching it very, very closely.
100%.
I think that's one thing we've all learned though with this whole coronavirus thing. Like, it's such a like ever changing thing. So like nothing you can make plans and like say, oh yeah, we're expecting this to happen by this date, but then because this is such an unknown like situation we're dealing with, we all know it's like subject to change, like nothing's set in stone.
Things
basically
can change in a week, exactly. Like, things can literally change in a week, but just never know.
Just listening to you guys, like, I'm that makes me hopeful because I want to believe that, yeah, the tour will like pick up again.
So, what did you think before that the tour wouldn't be?
To be honest, Lucy, I was thinking, you know what, this is going to have a real like a detrimental effect, like on things, like. And yeah, we might see a suspension like you've been saying for the past, 2 months, that yeah, just scrap the year. But now, like, I do think, yeah, tournaments just need to literally be just extra safe and like just make sure they're literally just going overboard with like when it comes to safety. Yeah. Have no ball kids.
Well, they're having a couple tours before the US.
Yeah, that, exactly. So there'll be a few events. Exactly. So it'd be interesting to see
how that
exactly
goes. Yeah. I think that'll be a good way for us to see as well how things are going to go. 100%. You never know. Some things might even not work out, and then they're like, you know what, let's crap this. But
and they look at, you know, they're kind of international as well with Sloane Stephens and Madison Keys. They'll be watching that.
Completely.
They'll be Lucy mentioned the Battle of the Brits as well. They will be watching that. Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that. I think I was just saying that they'll be watching other tournaments to see how they do it as well, just keeping an eye on things. That's why I haven't seen anything from the US Open. I haven't seen anything from the ATP. I was more interested the minute Dimitrov broke his news. I went straight onto Nick Kyrgios's social media.
Guy Nick.
At the time, because it was daylight for us here in England. I was thinking, oh, he's probably still asleep. So I was literally just waiting. How sad I am. I'm waiting to see what Nick Kyrgios' reaction was going to be. And he didn't fail to disappoint.
No, he laid in. He laid into them.
I mean, even Osaka was waiting for him. She posted a meme waiting for Nick. I was like, you know what? I love her on Twitter recently. I'm not going to lie. She's been a blessing.
But yeah, like, guys, I think it's important to kind of move on to more like promising news, and yeah, we kind of touched on it earlier with the whole Battle of the Brits that is literally now just finished. I want to say Dan Evans, he won the event, didn't he?
He did.
British number one, which is like obviously a good look for him. In terms of the whole event though, as well, like because that was held at the Roehampton like Tennis Centre, which is like the National Tennis Centre in the UK. Like I was really impressed with it. Like I thought this feels like a proper like ATP event. Like, just but obviously there were no ball kids. Like it was weird seeing the players like collect their own balls.
Can you imagine? You know, players actually been able to handle their own towels. I've been wanting to start a campaign for a long time for players to handle their own towels. The balls I can understand, right? You need to keep the six balls moving around the court. But towels and water bottles and bananas are not the responsibility of the players.
This is why people think tennis is hella bougie.
No, it's true.
Like, that's all these sports where they're like, you know, and things they'll be running like,
and then they'll just like dash the towel like back in the kid's face, like exactly. I don't like that, but yeah, that's literally.
And if anything comes out of this pandemic in terms of future tennis tournaments, they scrap the whole towel thing. Yeah. The players just sort it out themselves. Yeah. And I'm hoping that will continue for the rest of the season and into the new season of 2020.
Yeah. Well said. No, I agree with that. And like from our perspective, in terms of like the Blackspin Global like platform, it was good to see Jay Clark, although he lost to Dan Evans and then pulled out after that because he was injured. I thought he started that match like really promisingly.
He did.
Like
he
it was a good like standard, like good quality like match. I think that was on day one or day two?
It was day one.
And I remember the commentators saying, I think it was Barry Cowan saying how like, yeah, this is probably the most like high intensity like match we've had so far. Just because both players were playing like to quite a high level. Like I said, it's unfortunate that Jay Clark had to pull out after that. But Paul Jobb, who was another like replacement, because he wasn't originally in like the, you know, set lineup of players competing. But then he got called in, and yeah, he really impressed. Like I've been following Paul Jobb ever since, you know, he won the NCAA event last year. It's just like the huge college like title in America. And yeah, he's now gone pro. I think he signed to Andy Murray's management company as well. So like very promising future. Like he's 20, I want to say he's 20 years old. So just,
yeah, he's 20, yeah.
Still very young and like just exciting. And yeah, he beat Ryan Peniston, didn't he?
Yeah.
That match for me, like to see Jobb come in as a replacement. I don't think he'd played much tennis at all. Like obviously during lockdown, nobody really has. But yeah, that was like his first like match, I think, even like in terms of practice as well. Like, so for him to come in, like literally play at that level again, fantastic. But then he did lose to Cam Norrie in his second round robin match. And that was difficult to watch actually, because I think he lost the first set 6-love. And I was like, please at least get a game in the second, please. Cause he kind of started quite slowly in the second set again. But I think in the end he got 2 games, so it was love and two, but yeah, I think he can be pretty proud and like pleased with his efforts. Like this week coming in as a backup, like do you have any thoughts on Jobb, Amru?
Do you know, the one thing I will say is that I'm hoping that we will see more of these types of domestic tournaments. I think we need to see coming players and not just at, you know, June Wimbledon qualifying. And there's talk of back in the day, there was the British National Championships, I think it was called, that used to have tournaments like these. So you can see the up and coming, and then, you know, the calendar got changed. I really enjoyed it. I really liked it. And I think, you know, Paul Jobb's got a bright, bright future. I think Ryan Peniston's got a bright future. I think Jay Clark's got a bright future. It's just breaking that top 100.
It's tough.
It's really tough. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that works in their favour is if they look after their bodies, which I'm sure they do, eat well, keep up with their fitness levels, they can still play up until like Federer age.
Yeah, exactly.
100%.
If they can keep as injury-free as possibly can, then like, you know, they're in this for the long haul.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well said. I don't know, did you have any thoughts, Lucy?
No, I think both of you literally just clear up, to be honest. But in terms of the tour itself, I honestly really enjoyed it. I know it was a bit difficult for the players because it was really warm inside and stuff.
Especially
so
in the week,
Exactly. And it was really hot this week in the UK here as well. So I'm just hoping that, I feel like after having this conversation, I do think it is right to be having more of these, you know, domestic, national, you know, tournaments and stuff. We see a lot of other players, you know, that we don't really see, and it's good for them as well to play about and just have something a little bit different. And as long as it's done safely, like it's done with the Battle of the Brits, like I really like how everything was done really correctly and stuff. They were really strict to everything. And shout out to Andy also to making sure that all players, you know, were on their knees to, you know, show support to Black Lives Matter.
Can I say something about that, Lucy? Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah,
so the LTA posted a picture of that, of Andy Murray and the rest of the players taking the knee on their Facebook page. The comments underneath, some of them were absolutely outrageous. And I actually commented myself.
Good for you.
I said that I'll paraphrase, but I was really disappointed to see the tennis community, some of the tennis community, not all, but some, reacting in this way. And it was really disappointing. And, you know, good for the LTA for actually putting the picture up.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah. They're probably really proud of it, and they're proud of Andy, because I did wonder about Andy. I'm going to be honest. When the discussion really ramped up about Black Lives Matter, because I know he's very much about equality and feminism.
Yeah.
I did wonder, where is he going to go with this? Because I know there was some criticism about players using the blacked out square on their social media, and they're not doing a lot else.
Which we spoke about.
On your podcast. And I did wonder where Andy stood. And I've had to take a little bit of a step back and not judge people. If they didn't put up a black square, it doesn't mean that they're not doing anything. Maybe they just want to go away and think about it. And that's exactly what he said he did. He went away and he wanted to go and think about it. Read some stuff, talk to people, ask the questions and learn. And I'm all for that. I know some people are tired of having to explain certain things, but I'm of the thinking, if someone wants to ask me and wants to learn, who am I to turn them away to educate? Yeah. So I thought, actually, now you've answered my question. You understand it, you empathize with it, you want to support it. And I think that picture with all of them summed it up brilliantly.
There was a slight misunderstanding though. One of the matches, I want to say it was Cam Nori and Peniston actually. So the umpire asked, I want to say she asked Nori, like, are you not going to kneel? And I don't know what he said. The mic didn't really pick it up, but he just like kind of like dismissed it and just walked to the baseline to like start warming up. And I just thought to myself, okay, that's not really a great look. But then after that, literally every match. Before the start of every match, everybody kneeled. So I think they kind of made sure.
No, I think they didn't at that time because they both played earlier, I think.
Okay.
Well, like doubles, and they already did it. So I think he was like, they already done it. Let's go.
Mm.
But I was like, all right, cool. But at the end of the day, I still like the fact that they included, it might be a little thing, but we're talking about tennis.
Mm.
So that little thing to me, I felt like that's great. No, do you get what I mean? Like, the fact that in every single match, all of the players did that, I'm happy about that, because when it comes to these type of things, like we saw how when the whole Black Lives Matter movement really started a couple of weeks ago, everything that was going on, we saw how disappointed we were. So the fact that small little thing that, you know, Andy really wanted to implement to the tour, I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
Well, so let's just hope that in the future, we're going to see more than just taking a knee. Indeed. Like we're going to see a little bit more action, not just posting the black box and actually posting a link just right there, or not hiding it like certain big players, but you know, it is what it is.
The last event I kind of want to touch on before we move on to the second segment, the event currently taking place in Charleston. So it's Credit Bank One Open Capital, I can't remember the actual full name, but in that we've got Madison Keys, who's like the team captain for one of the teams, and Sloane Stephens, like, again, so she's on the same side as Madison Keys. Some notable like kind of wins. Sloane Stephens, she beat Eugenie Bouchard in straight sets.
That result doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Another like notable win, I think anyway, was team captain or tennis, is it Team Kindness? I think that's the name of their team.
Team Keys, Team Kindness.
Yeah,
I think
so Keys is captain of Team Kindness. She beat Sophia Kennan in three sets. So, like the Battle of the Brits, they play like a championship tiebreak in the third set. So she beat Sophia Kennan. I don't know what the score was in that tiebreak, but again, that's a big win because, you know, Sophia Kennan is literally the last player to win a Grand Slam this year. So like her form is incredible. Her confidence is like sky high, as it should be.
Yeah, she has good confidence.
Yeah,
definitely.
So for Keys to get that win again, like that should stand Keys.
Yeah, that's the one that surprised me because exactly what you said, Eugene. You would expect, you know, being a Grand Slam winner, her confidence is sky high. You'd think that she would have beaten Madison Keys. So yeah, I think it's an excellent point you've made.
We're moving on to the second segment now, and it's literally the spotlight is on our guest co-host, Anne-Marie Batson. So I guess it's fair to say you're a sports broadcaster, Anne-Marie. Like you've worked for the BBC, BBC Sport, Talk Sport as well, which is like a UK like radio station, Sky Sports as well. So like some pretty big names. But obviously you're on a tennis podcast, joining us on a tennis podcast. So like we want to get into your first like memories of tennis. Like, yeah, what were they like? What do you remember? Did you play like maybe when you were younger? Like, do you play now?
So I didn't play when I was younger. I remember being at primary school and the PE teacher handing out rackets and trying to get us to, you know, we're holding the racket. I'm right-handed, so the racket's in my right hand, and trying to balance the ball. So you've twisted the racket so it's on the edge of the racket, and you're trying to hit the ball on the edge of the racket. And I was absolutely rubbish at it. So then I kind of knew that tennis wasn't going to be a career for me in playing. However, my love for watching it came from watching Wimbledon all those many moons ago. And back in the days of CFAX, I used to come home from school and they'd be scrolling through the results, and I'd have my planner that would be from the newspaper on the Sunday, and I'd fill in the table, you know, for round one, to, you know, and then round two, round three, and then up to obviously quarterfinals to the final, and I'd fill it in physically, and then watch the highlights on BBC Two, and just totally fell in love with it. I loved the drama of it. I loved two players out there facing off against each other, and there's nobody else apart from obviously the crowd telling them what to do, but it's just these two trying to figure out how to overcome the other opponent and having balls coming at you at 90, 100, 120 miles per hour, being out on the men, you know, best of five, could be out there for 5 hours, the women could be out there for, you know, 4 hours, 2, 3, 4 hours. And I just loved the drama of it. And, you know, trying to get my head around the scoring system was quite hard in those first I would have been about 8 or 9 then, and I didn't really understand the scoring system. It wasn't until till I was about 11 or 12 that I started to understand the scoring system. But just then, it was just watching the drama of it and people literally holding their breath on the match point when it's been a really, really tight match, and the drama of the ball maybe going out or going into the net. And my love for Wimbledon every summer just grew and grew and grew. And then I started to find out about the French Open, and then about the US Open, the Australian Open. So my teenage years, it was my parents finally, after my mum had nagged my dad forever about getting Sky, we finally got Sky. And I'd go around their house and watch the Australian Open, because at that time of the morning, it would have been their evening.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At the time. And I was at university then, so I'd watch the Australian Open. I remember Nadal playing a match and screaming really loudly, oh, I'd won, and waking up my parents, kind of thing, who weren't too happy. And then just found myself thinking, well, actually, I'm not going to play it, so I want to talk about it. I want to write about it, but I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And it started from there.
Nice. So who were like the first players you kind of remember watching then? Like
Steffi Graf, that forehand of hers. Okay. I will never forget that forehand of hers. When she whipped it like anything. Oh my God. Just her and the whole Monica Seles beef.
Okay.
As it was then. Justin Henin, Andre Agassi, Pete Sampras. I remember watching the match between Pete Sampras and a very young Roger Federer wearing a bandana around his head. And playing
Federer, that's when Federer had like a bad attitude. Like,
Federer, it's really crazy to see the difference.
When he won, because he couldn't believe he's beaten Pete Sampras. I remember that. Oh goodness, like that. You know, that kind of, they were the players of my time.
Okay.
That, and also watching Chanda Rubin as well, Laurie McNeil. I remember when she made the quarters at Wimbledon, it was like, my God, there's a black woman who can reach the quarterfinals. Who else was it then at that time? I'm trying to think as well. Zina Garrison, I remember her as well.
Shouts out to Tsemeni, his piece.
I was about to say that.
Guardian on Zina, well, the Zina Garrison interview, like incredible, interview.
Oh goodness, it doesn't surprise me at all about the whole clothing sponsoring. It really surprised me, but shout out to him because it's a great, great piece, and I love what he says. You know, she's the first black woman. I wrote it down in the open era to reach a slam final, so I spoke to her.
it's a great tweet, definitely. No, that's interesting, Emery. So basically you didn't play, you just loved the sport in terms of watching it. Like, that's
Do you know what? I'm so happy to hear that, because I feel like whenever I speak to tennis fans, it's like, I feel like I'm the only person who's always like, I don't play it. I have never played it. But I just, the exact same way you describe it, I just love sitting down and just like that excitement, just seeing everyone and people being frustrated and angry and shouting. That's the thing. I was like, oh my God, I don't know what this is, but I love it. But it's the first time I'm actually hearing it. And I'm like, okay, I'm not the only one that's, you know, because everyone else is like, ah, you don't know how to play it.
Because I'm rude, like, did any of your friends like follow the sport as well? Or was it just really, were you like a lone ranger in that? Oh, really?
My sister loves tennis.
Okay.
Very much loves tennis. So, you know, we used to watch matches together. When Andy Murray won in Wimbledon 2013, she came around my house with me to watch it. I'll tell you that story another day. But it's actually a really good question. In terms of my friends, when I was at school and college, there was nobody really into tennis. It was just me. So I'd race home, you know, from secondary school. I lived out. Yeah. I grew up in a village, my family and I. So we'd have to get the bus to school, and I'd be wishing the bus to get home really quickly. It was June then for Wimbledon, and being able to get home and then watching the matches. And thank God for British summertime, because the matches would still be until 9 o'clock. And I was allowed to have a TV in my bedroom, so I'd watch as I'm doing my homework. That's the thing with tennis. I can still work and watch the match. So I'd still be doing my homework. And so, yeah, it was just me. And to this day, really, the friends that I have now in my life are not big tennis fans. I've literally, it's through the tennis community where I've made those friendships. Not to play the small violin, but it did feel a little bit lonely at times, because I love so much and I'm wanting to talk about it. And I didn't, this is before the days of YouTube and social media. Mm-hmm, I didn't really have anybody that I could, apart from my sister and my uncle, actually, he's a bit of a fan of tennis. But if I wanted to have that proper in-depth conversation, analytical insight, I didn't have that. I didn't have that.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because that's why even some of my friends, they were kind of like, oh, I didn't know you were into tennis that day. I was like, well, you guys are not into it, so I'm not talking to you about it, you know. On my Twitter as well, I couldn't see anything. It was after that I was realizing that, wow, there's actually a huge, like, black, you know, tennis Twitter fan type of, you know, like, people on the platform. And I was like, raw, like, I had no idea and stuff. And that's why I started following a lot more of that. So that's why I've been tweeting a lot more about it. But before, it was like, even with because my dad is kind of the reason why I started getting into it, because he would just watch, like, slams here and there. So, but even with him, at times I couldn't really speak about it, because he's not really watching it as up to date like as I am. Or he might know what's going on because he's watching like BBC News Sports and stuff and so on. So I definitely do like feel like, you know, that little loneliness and stuff like, oh, but now, you know, with the pod and following more people and stuff, it is, you know, talking to people like you guys, it does make it a bit more like, all right, it's okay now. It's not like back in the days.
So my uncle, he would get my sister and I tickets to go to Queens.
Nice.
And again, you know, he's a casual fan, so him and my sister, I could have those, like you said, Lucy, those kind of casual conversations.
Exactly.
But if you wanted to, like you said, those proper in-depth combos, it was lonely. And it was only because of really social media exploded that there was another community out there who loved this as much as what I did. So I started talking about it on social media, and I made friendships that way, and built friendships with people that actually work in tennis now.
That's how me and Eugene even got into this. No, you know, 100%. He had the platform running, and then, you know, I thought he was in America, like, yeah, and everything. And then he messaged me like, do you want a pod? I was like, yeah, in America. He's like, I'm here. Now look at us.
The rest is history. No, indeed. But no, I was going to say, Emery, so like, did you always have like the intention to kind of work in tennis media then, or kind of did it just kind of happen eventually, or did you like set out to work in tennis media?
No, I wanted to work in tennis media. I wanted to work in sport, and I saw myself as somebody who's able to talk about a number of sports, but my two specialisms were going to be football and tennis. And I remember, you know, watching Sue Barker.
Legend.
As she still does now, presenting on the BBC during the fortnight. I was thinking, that's the job I want. That is the job that I want. And God love you, Sue. If ever the day you retire, I'm going to be handing on my CV to the BBC. Chances are I'll probably never get it, but there you are.
Don't say
that was the thing. But I knew It was going to be a very long road. And it was by chance, actually, Eugene, where I got the opportunity to talk about tennis, is because I was going to a lot of Kick It Out events. Do you guys know about Kick It Out, the charity?
The football, yeah.
The football show, yeah. And I built up a good mutual friendship with the sports editor of The Voice newspaper. For those who don't know, The Voice newspaper is for the Afro-Caribbean community. The sports editor, his name is Rodney Hines. And we'd always see each other at mutual events and just chat about things. And he's a massive tennis nut as well. So we'd have those in-depth conversations. And we met up for a coffee one day. And he was saying, you know, I know you really love your tennis. Why don't you write a tennis report for me? And at that time, I'd been working in PR for a very long time in public relations, and I'd been wanting to make the switch into sports media. And I'd started networking and doing online courses and doing work experience. And then somebody says to me, well, actually, why don't you just do me a 300-word report on a tennis match, send it in, and I'll have a look. And I was incredibly nervous because the one weak area that I have is writing. Speaking, hosting, fine. Writing, I'm not 100% confident with, especially writing match reports, but he was willing to give me a go. So I sent it in. I can't remember which was the first one that I did. I think it might have been when Muguruza won Wimbledon.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. When she won Wimbledon. Sent it in. He sent it back going, can you make all these changes? There were loads of changes, but I learned a big lesson. Sent it back in, and the next thing I know, it's printed in the Voice newspaper.
Wow.
And he gave me more assignments. So when Sloane Stephens won the US Open, I wrote a piece about that. Nice. I wrote a piece about Venus Williams. And doing those pieces made me build my confidence. And then it was a case of the French Open was happening, and Serena Williams at the time, I think, had she given birth? It was the one where she wanted to wear her cat suit.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That was like 2 years ago, yeah.
So I can't remember, would Olympia have been born then?
I don't think so.
So I remember the French Open, I said to Rodney that I really wanted to go. Could I get accreditation? He sorted accreditation for me, but because the Voice newspaper wasn't one of like the big tabloids or the big broadsheets, I was only given accreditation for 5 days rather than for the whole tournament. But I took it.
Nice.
And I went over there, stayed in this tiny B&B near PSG's ground, which I was like, oh, near PSG. which was lovely. And spent 5 days at the French Open, and unfortunately only got to see Serena briefly. Then she pulled out with her shoulder injury when she was due to play.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. She did have Olympia.
She did have Olympia.
Okay. It was after. Yeah, it was after.
That's right. And then, so didn't get to see the whole drama of that. But being at that tournament just whetted my appetite even more. So I thought, right, now's the time to, you know, start putting out your articles on social media, start commentating about matches, not the sense of being a match commentator, but giving your insight or analysis or making a sarcastic comment about a player or something like that. And it's grown from theirs. And then because I had this portfolio of written articles, and because I'd started doing football reporting for the BBC, that's when they said, well, can you go down and interview Jamie Murray at the ATP finals? Nice. It's a last minute thing. We need somebody to go. You know, you're near London. You know your tennis.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. You know, go and do it. And it's grown from then on. And then approaching other people like TalkSport saying, look, I know a little bit about tennis. So if you need someone to make a comment, if there's a big tennis story, here's my number. And then sometimes they'll come to me. So it started from writing that match report for the Voice newspaper.
Wow.
And it's grown from then on. The one thing I will say is the tennis community is incredibly small. And I think with the football community is absolutely massive, because it's so big in this country. But with tennis, it's very, very small. And the opportunities are very few and far between. So as you said at the beginning, usually all these people that I've worked for, is because the BBC tend to, you know, they've got their person already that covers tennis. Sky Sports used to have tennis, but then it's moved on to Amazon Prime now. We'll only really cover it if there's a big story. I did the Australian Open for them, doing match reports for them for that. So it's only really the big Grand Slams. So those opportunities of working on it 365 days a year are quite slim. and people tend to stay in those jobs for a long period of time.
Yeah, that's true.
What you guys are doing, creating your own content, is the 100% right thing to do. And it might not seem, you know, you're looking at people who work on the BBC like Wimbledon and everything. That's only for 2 weeks of the year. You guys are doing it 365 days a year.
Indeed. Preach.
Yeah, and you're doing your own thing because there isn't somebody out there who's really doing that, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. No, but
whereas with football, because football, you can talk about it all year round. And I think we forget that tennis is pretty much, apart from 1 month of the year where they have that break between November and December.
Exactly.
It's tennis.
Yeah, yeah.
It is tennis.
They're playing on like New Year's Day, like in Australia.
Absolutely. So the reason I work for different clients, because I'm a freelancer, I work for myself, is because I have to take work where I can get it. And I'm very grateful that I've built relationships with all those people now. But for me to work in it full time, that's my ultimate. But I think I've still got a long way to go.
Yeah, you kind of touched on it earlier, like when you said how like the tennis media community is quite small. Like what, I want to like maybe delve a bit deeper. Like, so in terms of like the makeup, I'm assuming there aren't that many like female tennis journalists out there. Like, so the events you've worked, like I'm going to say you've probably been one of the very few like female journalists. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So if you look at the UK broadsheets and tabloid newspapers, they're all gentlemen who I've kind of seen in passing, or there's one or two that I know. So it's all gentlemen. When it comes to radio, though, you've got a few more women, particularly around Wimbledon. There's a few more female commentators, which is great. And you have Reshmin Chowdhury, who I love very much. She's one of the reporters for the BBC. You've obviously got Sue Barker, you've got Claire Balding. Amazon Prime, you've got
Catherine Whittaker.
So you're still seeing Annabelle Croft commentating, Sam Smith also commentating. And there's another lady who I can see her face in my head, but I can't think of her name, so I apologize. So there's a few more women now, which is great. But in terms of the written press, there isn't. My good friend,
the only written one that I know, which Tamani even mentioned before, is Carole Bouchard. She's actually French.
Yeah, so I'm talking about in this country, but internationally, yes, there's more writers. Like Carole Bouchard, Reem Abouil, who I think Tamani mentioned as. Well, Courtney Ewan, who writes for the WTA as well. But in this country, I mean, my good friend Roz Sattar, she runs a website, and I'm going to give her a slight plug, called BritWatch, which focuses on British tennis players. She runs it herself. It's a blog. It's a website. She's somebody of colour. She and I, you know, when I talked about those friendships, you know, she and I were messaging each other today about the Battle of the Brits, because we were having a deep discussion about it. So in this country, you're right, Eugene, in terms of female representation, it depends what medium you're looking at. Television is better than the written press.
To go even deeper, like I'm gonna say, I feel confident to say you are the only black woman covering the sport in this country, like without doubt. I'm gonna say,
as far as I know,
which is quite damning.
In terms of black,
which
is what I am. I'm you know, born in this country, but my mum's Jamaican, my dad's from Trinidad.
Yeah.
Nice. So Smalley Island discussions, please, if you understand all that. Oh God, it caused all kinds of problems before they got engaged. But that's a story. As far as I know, Tumani and I are the only black people who work on tennis pretty much most of the year. And that's something that I can't speak for Tumani, but that's something that I desperately want to change. Because to me, I look at tennis players and I think, in terms of ethnicity, my goodness, we are so spoilt from honestly. That perspective.
I'm sorry to cut you. I don't know about that, to be honest. I'm literally writing something at the moment, kind of addressing like the ATP and WTA's like response to the whole Black Lives Matter like movement, and like how for me they've been very quiet and like reluctant to kind of get involved and engage with like the content being posted by like black players, and not just black players but players in general. When I like kind of looked into things a bit deeper, there are currently, so if you look at the top 100 in the men's game, there are five black players that are ranked inside the top 100. So you've got Gael Monfils, Felix Auger-Aliassime, Joe Wilfred Tsonga, Francis Tiafoe. Who's the fifth? There was a fifth in there. Mikael Ymer of Sweden. So that's five guys. On the women's side, again, top 100, there are nine. And like, I just think those numbers are quite depressing. Like, considering, like we've discussed and we've kind of mentioned it earlier, like the sport it's a global sport, but yet numbers in terms of like black competitors, like it's scarce. So that's something I'm like looking to address, or we're looking to address, like with this platform, like because I want to get the black interest in the sport. I want to raise that interest and like, you know, kind of make.
That's why when like little stuff like when Osaka was number one in the Forbes, I was hitting all my friends like, guys, we have the kids, send them to my house. 2 weeks, we're gonna do like, you know, some tennis boot camp. We're all going to, you know, we're gonna make some money, you know.
The reason I said that we are spoiled because we could have zero.
True.
I will take the nine.
Yeah.
I will take the nine because of the sport is seen. And it can be seen as still being seen very elitist and very white. We have not. And I know what you're saying. It's not double figures. And it is not good enough. But hell, it's better than zero. Mm. If you look at golf, and I've got real beef with golf.
Yeah.
I like watching it. Don't understand the scoring system too much, but I do like watching it. You know, the thing that I've said to people is football, and pardon the pun, takes an enormous kicking when it comes to diversity, and it's still got a long way to go, and we all agree about that.
Yeah.
Off the pitch and behind the scenes. But other sports, I think, tend to hide behind it. When do you really have the spotlight shone on golf? You know, Tiger Woods, as far as I know, is the only person of colour in the pro top ones, top 100 or top 10, top 20. Okay. Rugby union were a little better. Cricket were a little better. Tennis in this country, not so good.
Yeah.
But internationally, it's better. Football blows it all out of the water in terms of on the pitch.
Completely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now you're starting to see, when I did the newspaper review today, there are now stories of looking at other sports going, well, what are you doing to increase diversity on and off the pitch, the track, the court?
Yeah.
And people are now looking at golf going, well, what are you doing? And looking at cricket going, this isn't good enough. And now looking at tennis. And now, because it's all about accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Now people are feeling more confident and saying, how are you going to be made accountable about this? Because this is not good enough anymore. So I will take that nine. Yeah. And we've got, in terms of the women's side, I think the men's side, we could do a lot better. But in terms of, we have nine, at least on the women's side, that's, you know, that's a starter. If it was zero, I'd be screaming and shouting, go, this isn't good enough. You know, and these are people with personalities. They've got things to say as well. They're characters, they're engaging, they're charismatic, they're jokey as well, charming. So, yeah, I'm not saying via long shot that tennis is out of the woods. It's not. But it's for me personally, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well said. I agree with that, definitely. But
I think we also need to think about the accessibility to tennis. No, you get what exactly, I mean? Like, it's not a cheap sport, you know. Unfortunately, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of little black kids that wanted to get into it, but, you know, couldn't afford it. And that's what I'm hoping, once these black players who are going to get, you know, if they once retire or whatnot, they really focus on that so we can have more of these black people into the sports. And it doesn't even have to be a player. It could be a coach. You could be anything. You could literally just be anything. We just need more black faces literally everywhere.
We do. And, you know, you can have you're having all these schemes. The LTA will have a scheme, and the ATP and WTA will all have these schemes, which is right. And the irony is, when you look at tennis, all you need is a tennis racket and a tennis ball and a wall to start with. But you're right, Lucy, it's when, if someone decides it to take it to that next level, that's where, I don't want to say problems, but where the challenges
start.
And there are various, I know the LTA have got various programs to help manage that. They're looking to address it now even more. The thing is, though, it's that word I said, it's about accountability. It's no longer acceptable to say, well, we need a bit of time to get this thing. No, you don't have time.
You don't
have time anymore. And I'm that passionate about the sport because I want to see more colour. I want to see more black faces as a coach in administration, in governance, in the media. It can only help. Develop the sport as well. And I will never accept this argument about, you know, in the UK, or I should say for England, you know, only there's only 3% of black people. Well, that was data taken from the last census, which was like 5 years ago. So try again next year when we have the census, because I think the map would have changed somewhat quite a lot. But I'm desperate for tennis to be a sport for everybody. And if I can use my platform, as they say, to do that, then I want to do that, because it is a sport. Sorry, I'm on my soapbox now, because it is a sport. And if I want to see somebody else, I want to see you guys succeed, because I think what you're doing is absolutely fantastic. I want other people, of black people, Asian people, and other minorities to get involved in the sport as well. Let's dispel this thing that it's elitist. Let's dispel this thing that it's just for white people. Yeah. It's not. Sport isn't just for one particular person. It's for 100%.
Exactly. No, I completely. Yeah. Well said, definitely. But yeah, like to kind of bring us back on track. So yeah, back to you, Emery, in terms of your career. So last year, which kind of ties in nicely, considering we're in June, heading into July, it's Wimbledon time. And like, yeah, you played a big part in like Wimbledon's coverage. I want to say it was the YouTube channel that you were working on.
Yeah, so Wimbledon have got their own. They've got their own channel. They do some brilliant stuff on social media, and it was all down to timing and luck, I would say, because I'd spoken to Leon Mann, who I'm not sure you guys know from BCOMS.
Yeah, I know Leon. Yeah,
he and I would have these long conversations about tennis, and he knows how passionate I am about the sport and how much more I want to get involved from a media perspective. So he put me in touch with the contact at Wimbledon, and I spoke to this contact, and she said they were putting together a show that was going to go out on YouTube under the Wimbledon banner. It was going to be a preview show, looking at the day, have some guests. It's going to be going out live. We've seen your showreel. We've seen, because by then I'd had a showreel. We've seen what you can do. Let's have a conversation about it. And I had a conversation with them, and then I spoke to the production company. And the next thing I know, I'm getting booked to do the show for the 2 weeks of Wimbledon, but also covering some of the warm-up events before Wimbledon as well. So I went to Birmingham. We did a day up in Birmingham.
That's the women's event in Birmingham.
Yeah, that was the women's event. Yeah, that was the women's event. And then that was Nature Valley. And then we headed down to Eastbourne, which I absolutely love, because I got to interview Simona Halep, Carl Edmund, and Jay Clark at Eastbourne, which was great. And then doing the live show every day at Wimbledon. It was an amazing experience.
How like, in terms of like, what was the day like, in terms of like, yeah, so the day to day, you said it's daily, what time
it was daily. So I'd be down on I was living down there at the time, because it would have been madness for me to stay in Essex. It's Wimbledon every day, so I ended up staying quite close. I'd get the train in, I'd get the 6:45 train, if I remember rightly. So I'd get up about 5:30, I would say, because I want to have breakfast, get dressed, sort myself out at the station, get the 6:45, get on site for 7:30 in the morning, and then the production team would arrive, and we'd go through the script of the day, look at the topics of the day, any big stories from the day before. We'd look at the VT as well, like the top 5 shots of the day, big surprises of the day, those kinds of things. Then we'd have a rehearsal. Probably 2 rehearsals in the early, those first few days we had 2 rehearsals, but then we started to get into a bit of a rhythm, so we'd cut that down to 1 day, and then we'd be on the, then we'd have a break, go and get some breakfast. Wimbledon does amazing breakfasts, I've got to say. And then we were actually on the broadcast roof, so we had a good view of the whole site, and we could see all the courts. We'd be near to the big main show courts of the center court and court number one court, I should call it. And then we'd be on the air from about 10 o'clock. So we'd have to be in position around about 20 to 10, make sure we've got our earpieces in, because it's all live, make sure the script is tight, we know who's doing the introduction, the guests are ready, and then 10 o'clock we'd go. And that would go on till about 11, and then we would hand it over to the Wimbledon channel, and then we would come off air, we'd have a quick wrap-up meeting, go through anything that didn't work or work, And then in the afternoon, I'd still be working. So we would film some features. So my role predominantly during that 2 weeks was to interview people who work at Wimbledon. So I talked to the security guards, the dogs, which was great fun. We spoke to the head of the stewards as well. We spoke to the head gardener. I never thought I'd say this, but I have a garden and I look after it. And I was asking all kinds of questions. I interviewed the pastry chef as well, which was a real delight. And yeah, and also we spoke to Jamie Delgado as well. Nice. So in the afternoon, so we'd film these features, which would then be edited, ready for the next day. And there was myself and my co-presenter, Danny Jameson, and we would alternate. So one day he'd be doing the features in the afternoon, and then I would do the social media. That was the other thing as well. We had to do videos for social media.
That was a lot.
With a lovely young American called Heather Crowley, who I'm still in touch with today. And I would spend the afternoon with her, and we'd go to all different round the site, and we would film videos for Instagram, mainly for Instagram, to be honest, and for Facebook, just talking about the Wimbledon Museum, for example, or we'd be at the queue. If you want to buy some strawberries. So it was a busy day. So I would get signed off round about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And then I would stay to watch a couple of the doubles matches, or if there was any singles matches still going on. At that time, I would go and watch for about half an hour just to sort of like decompress, and then get the train home. And it would start off all again. And the only day I had off was the middle Sunday because there was no rain. It was an intense schedule. But I definitely say I loved doing the show. And the day when they let everybody, that morning when they let everybody in behind the rope as they're leading the crowd through, you can see all the stewards and you hear this hum of people and it's getting louder and louder as they're making their way into the site, and then they release the rope and everyone just runs for Hemman Hill and gets the best spot at Hemman Hill. And that first thing, the place is absolutely rammed. You cannot imagine. With a camera crew, it's really warm. Everybody's all around. And then the second week, it starts to filter out a bit more and a bit more. And the crowd starts to drop. But yeah.
It sounds like a great experience.
An amazing experience. Seeing the media room, you know, media from all around the world. I had the opportunity to sit on a couple of press conferences as well.
I want to say, not to cut you, I did see you spoke to Reem, but I think that was probably during the live broadcast of it. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Okay. So we would try and have a journalist on each day just to give us a view about how the tournament's going and any particular players. Nick McCarville, we had him every day. He was brilliant fun as well. And Adam, who would talk about the social media side things, because we encouraged people to use the hashtag Coffee Morning and send in their tweets or on Facebook, read them out live on air as well. So for me, you know, doing it was a live show, having a director in my ear and looking straight into the camera and having to, keep to time and sometimes having to ad lib, but we have the scripts in front of us just in case. An amazing experience. And that last day, because we did the finals day, the men's finals, and then we had to come back on the Monday to do a wrap up show, and the place was like it was like a graveyard.
Yeah, it's so depressing. I hate it every time.
I'm using that word, but it was, so you imagine, you know, going from that time where it's mega mega busy, people around, and then all of a sudden it's just like there's a few bodies walking around. But I will say, I mean, there was tons of favorite moments, but one of my other favorite moments is getting to see the players practice. Before the tournament actually started, we would do rehearsals up on the roof, and you'd see, you know, I remember seeing Roger Federer just walking around with his coach going to practice, and Novak Djokovic walking around. Nobody talked, you know, they'd say hello to people, but they're just going about their day. Stan Wawrinka was another one I saw as well, just going about their day. You know, nobody really like going, oh my God, is Stan Wawrinka? Just getting on with their jobs, and I liked that a lot, really. But so many, I could tell you so many brilliant moments about it, and that really made me think, Anne-Marie girl, you know what, this is the ultimate for you. This is 100% you. You know, from going from that little girl who'd sit in front of the TV at home, filling in, you know, the order of play and things like that, you know, to presenting a live show on the broadcast roof at SW19.
Arguably the biggest, like, Grand Slam in the world as well. Like,
biggest Grand Slam in the world. And then me kind of like popping my collar because I interviewed Simona Halep at Eastbourne and then she wins the title. Oh, it's all down to me.
So I guess that's fair to say, like, it's fair to say that's probably been like your highlight, like, or the highlight of your media career so far, or tennis media career anyway.
That's a tough one. Usually, that's really tough.
Really?
Yeah, because I think,
What can beat Wimbledon? What can actually beat Wimbledon?
Do you know what? Because I'm all a little bit humble about it and think, do you know what? I don't want to say it's been the best yet because I've just scratched the surface of what I've
been. Okay, so maybe to date then. To date, it's been...
Up to this date, I would say 100% it's, you know... And of course, you had the women's World Cup happening at the same time. So there's a real buzz around the place. So Wimbledon, up until this point, in terms of doing a big event, a big tournament. Yeah,
exactly. 100%. Especially a tournament like Wimbledon, like, is one of the most popular sports tournaments in general, not even in tennis. Exactly. Like, in sports, like, you tell someone Wimbledon, you know what they like. They might not know who player where it is, but they don't know exactly what you're talking about, what it looks like and everything. So that's really big. It's really, really big.
No, really, really nice, like, insight and background there. Like, thanks for sharing that.
It's the longest days. You know, again, when you go to cover a football match, just using that as an analogy, you know, you get there 2 hours beforehand, you go to the media room, you set up, you do your notes and what have you, go out, report on the match, send it on the final whistle if you have to, or then you do your report afterwards. And then you go home, you know, that's maybe, 6 hours, shall we say. With tennis, it's all day. Mm. And the one thing I'm thankful for with Wimbledon is that the cutoff is 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Because of the council or whatever, maybe 9:30, they can push it a little bit.
Well, on the outside courts.
On the outside courts,
So
I'm glad that, because if you're doing, you know, I've had my friend Roz who does, she's done the Australian Open, and I've had friends who've been doing they will play until like 2-3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Starting at 11 o'clock. So you get there 2 hours beforehand and you might not even leave for another 19, 20 hours.
Crazy.
So, yeah, it's they are long days, but you do it because you love the sport.
Would you?
Of course, yeah.
All things like in a world of no coronavirus, would you have been doing that again this year or?
I don't think so. I think the plan was for them to, because it was kind of, it was a test to see how well it was going to be received. And apparently everyone really, really loved it.
Yeah.
What they want to do is absorb it into, I mentioned the Tennis Channel, which is their more, it's the channel that pretty much runs all day. So they talk to the players, they look at the match, you've got commentators, and they were going to merge it as part of that. Mm. So I don't think, unfortunately, I would have played a part in that. As disappointing that is, I just brush it off and think, okay, I played a part.
Yeah.
100%,
work, they love it. They're going to take it away and use it for something else now. But that means I've got that on my CV.
No, big time.
Exactly.
Big
time. Exactly.
Away from me. But I would have worked on it in some capacity. Maybe, you know, not with this particular team, but I would have worked on it in some capacity somehow.
Yeah. You kind of touched on all the stuff before. So, because you worked at a few events leading up to Wimbledon. So, you say Eastbourne and Birmingham?
So, I filled some features at Eastbourne. I also did, I did Birmingham as well at Edgbaston as well. So, it was, and I was meant to do a few more, but because of budget and timings, it didn't happen. But, doing the WTA events leading up to Wimbledon was great fun.
You've got your own series on YouTube, so you've got the getting to know you or getting to know the web series. Like, when did that start, and what made you start that? Basically,
that started a week after lockdown, actually. And I'll cut a long story short, but friends of mine who are content creators and producers have been badgering me for ages, and I will use the word badger because they were badgering me about, you should create your own stuff. There's not enough tennis content out there. You should take advantage. And I'd always thought, well, because I'm a freelancer, I need to earn money. And if I'm doing my own thing, that means I'm not going to be earning my own money because I'm not going to get sponsors because there's not enough eyes on it and all this kind of thing. So I kind of just batted it away. And then lockdown happened, the tragedy of coronavirus happened. And it just got me thinking about, well, tennis players are not really going to be doing a lot, apart from trying to keep their fitness up. So I approached a friend of mine who had a good contact with a tennis player and said, look, I'm thinking about doing this 10-15 minute interview with somebody. And my contact knew Katie Dunn, who's a British tennis player. She's outside the top 100. I said, I just want to do a 10 minute chat with her because I want to find out about her. I know who she is as a tennis player, but I know her as a person. And he put me in contact with her. She agreed to do it. And it's grown from then on. I think I've done about 10 now. I'm due to do one tomorrow. And it's literally me in conversation with tennis players outside the top 100 and getting to know them as a person. As I said, their personalities, their thoughts, what their goals are, family life, friends, all those kinds of things. And I put it out on social media and it's had an okay response, I think.
Have you found as well that like tennis players have been quite, or they've received it well, like, or being approached, like they're open to talk because...
Yeah, very much so, very much so. I think the thing is, I'm looking for people outside the top 100. I think when they're in the top 100, it's a different ballgame to be there. And the thing is with me, I've always had this plan in my head of wanting to build, I wanted to work for myself, but two, have this empire of doing different things. So I'm being a reporter, I work as a host, I do Q&As, I do podcasts like with you guys, but I also wanted to produce my own show. And this is the start of that, of it's my concept. I book it all. I get in contact with the tennis player. I put a pitch to them of what I'm looking to do. I write the script. I book, you know, all the arrangements, logistics. I record it. I edit it. And then I put it out on social media. That's all done by me. And that's what something I really wanted to do. So approaching players outside the top 100 is easier because they don't have, they're not necessarily in the public eye as much. I really wanted to shine a light on those who don't necessarily have a high public profile. But then I ended up having a conversation with Tara Moore, who's got a really good profile of tennis in this country as well.
It's quite outspoken as well.
Ryan Penniston the other day. I'm speaking to Eden Silver tomorrow.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But they've all been so lovely. That's the thing. They've all been really accommodating. And I always say, is there anything that you do not want me to talk about? This isn't an interrogation. I don't want to know. I'm curious. And not one of them has said to me, no, I don't want to talk about this. They've all been really, really open. And also for them, it's an opportunity to practice their skills.
Yeah, exactly.
When they have to talk to somebody from the media, because we're not all predators and we're not all like want to catch you out and interrogate you. Sometimes you find out who you are.
Yeah. The next segment, guys, this time last year, Wimbledon 2019 belonged to Coco Gauff. I think that's fair to say. I think everyone can agree on that. And like we all know like what happened in terms of, you know, she came through qualifying. I don't think she didn't drop a set in qualifying. So she played three matches, won them all in straight sets. She was 15 years old at the time, and like people in the tennis world kind of knew of her. Like, I think she won the French Open Juniors the year before.
She was the junior number one.
And like got to the US Open like final as well. Like, so as a junior, she had like pedigree, obviously. But then to come in, like I said, at 15 years old, and just literally, she took the world by storm. Like, there's no really way to put it. Like, I can't really think of many like superlatives to like
people who don't watch tennis. Like, when I was coming in at work, oh my gosh, have you heard of that 50? I was just looking at her. I heard of her, but like literally, like everyone was just going at it. Like, when she came in, especially with the first match being against,
exactly,
you know,
iconic. It was an iconic like first round match. Like, what a way to kind of start or announce yourself like to the world. Like, I don't know, but like, what were your first thoughts, Emery, when you first saw Coco Gauff?
Who is this person? Was the thing that popped into my mind, because I was just seeing the way that she was playing. Again, it's that word that I used earlier, fearless, absolutely fearless. Didn't faze her. Crowd, you know, the Wimbledon crowd can be really raucous. And she wasn't fazed by that. The confidence that she brought with her, as you mentioned, Eugene, you know, she came through qualifying with flying colours. You know, to take on Venus Williams, somebody you've admired, you've watched growing up, whose game you've probably studied, to come out onto a big court, because Venus isn't going to do no outside court. You know? So, you know, and not be utterly fazed by it, because that could have completely overwhelmed her.
Mm.
And she handled it brilliantly and continued to handle it briefly up until, I would say, the Simona Halep match.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. I think even a lot of people even thought when they saw Halep, they're like, I think this is, you know, this is she managed this time. But the fact that she literally even passed just Venus. And funny enough, going back to that Spider-Man meme, I posted it when they were playing against each other, because it was literally like a young Venus and like an old
It's like Venus was playing a younger version of herself.
Yeah. I was like, I could not believe it. I was like, what? This is scary. Like, it was, yeah.
I remember seeing Venus, my sister and I, the first time I actually went to Wimbledon as a fan, and I won tickets to the quarterfinals of Wimbledon. I took my sister, and it was to see Venus play. And she, you know, she's so, I mean, I've seen her in the flesh as well. She's so tall. Yeah, that's the thing with tennis players. I'm only like 5'6". And I remember, you know, she walked by me one day and also seeing her play. And I was like, my God, she's so tall.
She does.
It was like the mirror image of each other.
Yeah. And the scary thing with Coco, like, she's still growing, because she's now 16. So she won't stop growing until 18, 19. So she'll probably grow a few more feet, like, which is quite scary to think. But yeah, I, Lucy, I don't know if you, well, obviously we're going to get to you, but when I first saw Coco, I was like, you know what? This is literally a result of, you know, Venus and Serena in terms of their, like...
impact.
Exactly. On the game of women's tennis anyway. Yep. Like, this is the result of it now. And, like, it was just such a powerful thing to see. Like, and I not that I got emotional, but I did think, like, this is more than just, like, a tennis match you're watching here. Like, 100%. It's something so significant. And, like we've said again, like the fact that she went all the way to the second week, she came up short against Halep,
that's the only time Venus will lose on the first round, and I'd be like, okay.
Didn't she? The Australian Open.
Exactly.
Backed it up. That's the thing with tennis. It's great getting that win, but you got the pressure is on to back it up. And she did back it up. And yeah, it's great for her that she's somebody who has the game to carry her through. I mean, I'm not going to say carry her through. She has the game to win matches to make sure she gets through to the round of 16.
Yeah, the second week.
The one thing I will say, and I mentioned that Simona Halep match, is that I was briefly reminded when Simona Halep really started to turn the screws, and it led up to this whole, the Serena final, but I was reminded for a second that she's still 15.
Mm.
The look on her face when it's dawning on her, this isn't going the way that the other match is gone, because this is Simona Halep, to be honest, and we have to be fair, she's another level.
Oh, big time.
I looked at Coke and I thought, she reminded me for a second that she's still a young woman.
Yeah.
That she's, at that time, she was still 15. And just for a second, I thought, we have to be mindful of that. And she has amazing talent, and as you rightly say, Eugene, she's still growing, she's probably going to head over
the thing,
but emotionally she's still learning about emotions and all that kind of thing, and the look on her face when it was match point, I thought, that tells me now that that's one thing, especially
I feel like with tennis as well, I feel like with sports in general, but especially with tennis, it's all about mental as well. Oh, the moment, especially once a player is like knows it, the moment they know that, I'm in your head, that's it, I'm going to win. So I think, again, like you said, anyways, she is like still younger and stuff. I was even a little bit concerned when it happened the first time. I was like, it's Wimbledon, you know, and stuff. When it happened the second time, that's when I was like, this is something that she definitely does need to work on, because, you know, like, you don't want people to see that, because when it's on court, fam, these girls are ruthless. They don't care who you are. They're ruthless.
I have no doubt it's that magic time of that 16, 17, 18 years of age. I have no doubt that she will reach a semi-final and the final. I've got no doubt about that whatsoever. I also want her to enjoy being a teenager.
Yeah.
I remember those days of Jennifer Capriati. I remember the massive fallout of that, that burnout that she felt. And Coco Gauff, from what I understand, she's talked about the stresses of being a tennis player. She's talked about dark periods of being a tennis player, and her parents and her support around her are helping her and managing her. And I applaud that. She needs that right now. And I want her to enjoy. You know, I'd love to go back being 16 again, because there are certain things in life that I decided at that time that I would never do. I'm older and wiser. You don't get that time back. So I'm desperate for her to enjoy being a teenager. She's talked about that she may want to go to college. I think that's and do stuff online, do like an online university course. I think that's a really good idea. Enjoy those things of being a tennis player and all the fruit of labor that brings you. But also enjoy being Coco the person.
No, and well said. I think huge credit should go to her parents, because the role they've played is like incredible. Like her dad, Corey, is her coach. And her mum, Candy, is like, you know, her mum obviously first and foremost, but also her tutor. Like, so she homeschools her. So like to kind of have that responsibility of, you know, your daughter is literally now she's a global superstar. Like, there's no other way to put it. At 16, like it's quite a tough job, because you've got to literally balance the job of being a parent, but then also you're kind of managing a brand, because that's what Coco Gauff is now. Like, and it's crazy to say it. She's 16 years old now, but yeah, like I'm just super proud. I'm super proud of her as well. Like, as just
100%.
As someone looking in as a fan, like the way she carries herself, like. Yeah. All the stuff she's been doing,
even during her conferences, like the way she's so confident and stuff, is like, wow, like you even have it more than me, or even more than when I was your age. And it's like,
exactly,
that's the kind of confidence that you need to have in tennis as well. Yeah. Like, they're always trying to humble you, and I love how she's not afraid to, you know, speak up, say what she has to say, and do. Fam, when Federer posted that little black box, what did she do? She called to me that with a link.
I do want to come to that, but just leading up to all of that, like she kind of backed up the Wimbledon like performance by going quite deep at the US Open. So she got to the third round, she got to, and again, that was her debut at that slam. She lost to Naomi Osaka. Like, again, what an epic moment that was, like in women's tennis. And then she won her first like WTA title in Linz, I think it was, in Austria, indoors. And like, again, like to see that a 15-year-old, I think she was the youngest player to win a WTA title since, I want to say 2004, which is the year she was born, which is just wild. So like she's backed up the Wimbledon performance with like performances outside of Wimbledon in terms of these tournaments, like I said, the US Open, the stuff on the WTA tour.
And she's playing doubles as well. It's
a great point. So she's got two doubles titles with Cassie McNally, who's like a good friend of hers as well. And like you said, Anne-Marie, like that is it's a huge thing, because that does help your game in terms of a tennis player, like the all-round, you know, serve, volley.
100%,
You know, it's not just all big ground strokes, you know, from the baseline, which she does have in her arsenal. And again, to think that she's so powerful again at 16 years old, like she's got so much power, like it's scary to think like how good she's going to be come like 20, 21, 22. So I think literally the sky is the limit. But what one thing I kind of want to focus on as well is like all the stuff, although it does make me feel uncomfortable, and I'd be interested to kind of hear your views on this, Anne-Marie, like with the whole Black Lives Matter movement kind of taking over at the moment, which is great, like we want the awareness, and it's brilliant that things are finally being discussed like out in the open. I do kind of resent the fact that someone like a Coco Gauff, who's a kid, like there's no way other way to really put it, she's a kid, like she's almost become like an activist. And as much as I like love it and I appreciate it, like it's upsetting to see, because that should not be happening. Like I don't know what are your views on that.
Well, I'm gonna throw the question back at you. Why do you not think it should be happening?
Just because she's 16 years old, like she's a kid. And like I think for your non-black tennis players, like they do not have the same kind of, that's not a concern for them, because they're not black. So, yeah. And me and Lucy, we've discussed this before in the past as well. Like, that's, that's something.
I was saying more, you know, I was saying more of like, I was more like, not ashamed, I can't find the word, but I didn't like how the older generation, or like, you know, older people and older white people caught tweeting her saying, oh my gosh, so you're so brave, you're so incredible. And it's like, you guys really should have been doing this as well. Like, don't you have that little shame that you're seeing a little kid, like you said earlier, that really, that it's good that she's talking about these things, but the way she is going on about it, that's meant to be your job for her generation and then so on. But like,
yeah, I think well, go on, sorry, Lucy, go on.
But like, she's still like 16 and she's out here telling people, listen, I can't vote, but you can vote and you can make a change. I understand. And everyone is, you know, clapping like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm like, come on, man.
And they're both very valid points. And I'm not going to disagree with either of those. It shouldn't be just on her shoulders. We've seen TFO doing his fantastic video. Yeah. Serena, to be fair to her, has been talking about this for a very, very long time. I'll always remember Indian Wells. My God, that was horrific, of her being booed and what have you. So, you know, she talks about it. We can go back even further. And Arthur Ashe, God love him, God rest his soul, somebody who, a black man who won Wimbledon, the Australian Open and the US Open, who was very vocal about equality and civil rights. History has shown us there's always one person who has to carry the heavy load. And in this moment in time, it is her, but thankfully she's sharing it with others around her, like Naomi Osaka.
Indeed, yeah.
She's not just carrying this baggage on her own. And I think what's important about her is that she won't allow it to disappear. She wants people to make sure it's in the forefront of their minds. Have you seen on her social media this week?
Yeah.
I thought it was really good. The tweet that she did about Breonna Taylor.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I thought that was genius. That's genius to doing that. But there's always been somebody who has to carry that heavy load to open the door for somebody else. Serena started it, but you had people before that, as I've mentioned, you know, Althea Gibson, Laurie McNeil, Chandra Rubin,
Zena Garrison.
Each one of those has opened the door a little bit more and a little bit more. What Coco's doing is literally just blasting it off. Other people around her to support her. If there are white allies that want to get on board, who am I to say it's not your fight? We welcome more voices.
Fair enough.
More voices. And you're right, she shouldn't be carrying it on her own, and I hope that she doesn't think that she's carrying on her own, because there is a tennis community out there that will support her and TFO and all the others
in
you know, running this out of town in terms of racism in our lives.
No, 100%.
And what is brilliant, I mentioned right at the beginning about tennis players now have personalities. She has a fantastic personality. Naomi Osaka has a great personality. TFO, he's so funny, joking, he's humble. These are great characters. These are fantastic characters. And we need more of that in tennis. And I applaud them for having the guts to go, I'm not just a tennis player, but I'm also somebody who has an opinion. And I'm also somebody who wants to affect change.
Yeah.
Who are we to say not to do that?
No, that's well said. Definitely. I can't really argue with any of that at all. So, no, that's very well said. I don't know if you have anything else to add, Lucy.
No. And I just hope, like you said earlier, that, you know, she's not the only one doing this. It will be like everyone coming in together and making the effort, black, white, Asian, blue, whatever you are.
Yeah.
Just coming in and just making a change. That's it.
Yeah.
They won't allow it. They won't allow it. I think certain players will not allow the issue to die away. Nick Kyrgios has been very vocal about it. They won't allow it now. And I think whereas before, 5-10 years ago, even Serena was and Venus were probably the only lone voices then.
I think
the newer generation coming through is now saying it's all about that word, accountability.
Yeah.
That's a great way to end it, guys. I think that's very impactful.
Before we go, I know Eugene doesn't like to do this because I like to, start a little bit. So we were minding our own businesses and trying to sleep. And then Eugene, I wake up to a beautiful message telling me that Venus Williams had liked one of the posts on a black spin.
No!
And listen, yeah. I was like, you know, I was like, you better post about this. You better, you know,
wow.
This is big. So this is just the beginning, guys, you know. So really happy about that. And again, to Eugene for running that page. He's always, you know, on point.
It's a team effort.
And doing all of that. So it's a lot more likes from Venus and everyone else.
Eugene, when things really blow up, I'm going to come to you for a job.
I'll happily have you on board, happily. To add to that, actually, Lucy, Sloane Stephens liked to post, actually, I think I want to say last night. So this is the beautiful thing about this. Like,
you need to open your mouth and say something.
It's just the people who we're celebrating, like they're actually seeing it. And that, for me, that's like one of the most beautiful things like about this. So again, Anne-Marie, like, thank you so much for coming on, like, and co-hosting with us, because again, your voice is very important, and like, there aren't many of you out there, so we need to like amplify, you know, your voice, and for you to come on our platform and like kind of share like your views and thoughts, like it's really important. So I can't really emphasize and like stress that enough.
Thank you for inviting me. I've loved it. I could have, you know, we could talk for hours. Hours.
I think so, yeah.
I have to say, I did a podcast last year called The Beautiful Game Podcast. You've probably seen it.
Yeah, the football guys.
And we were supposed to start recording, let's say, like at 11 o'clock, but we were still chatting about tennis until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And they love tennis as well, those lads. And we were talking about it and talking about it. So for me, this is a real joy for me, because like I said right at the beginning, I don't really get to talk about tennis with a lot of people. So no, thank you for letting me just rant and rave and give a view. And it's been lovely chatting with you guys. And I think what you guys are doing are brilliant. And if I can do anything to support it, and when you get your empire going, Eugene, I'm there. I want a job. And Lucy's going to be the CEO. And I'll just come and help you do your media for you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way to end it. So I will say as well, guys, like, thank you again, like, for the likes and like, interaction on social media. Like, it's really appreciated, and like, we do see it. So I do want to say that, because I'm quite poor when it comes to like saying that at the end of episodes. Lucy's the one that's always on my case. So thank you so much for tuning in again for another episode. It's been great, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks' time. So thank you. Take care.